Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant evening to everybody on board. I hope everybody's having a good week. This is Rob Starr along with Mr. Chris Davies. Chris, how are you, sir?
Linda, thank you very much. Beautiful weather out here. It's a good thing. You know what I'm thinking? It's a good thing we broadcast in color because it was a gorgeous day today.
Well, hopefully soon we can all return to the real studio and they can actually see us instead of a little logo that they stick up. And maybe we should get them a new picture or something to put up there. So I think that might be something good to do. Yeah,
all
beautiful
right.
Weather here. It's been really windy. I think we got the winds that you had last week. They were pretty bad here yesterday.
Yep. I hope you tied everything down on your nice new property out there.
Yep, we did. And tomorrow it's supposed to be beautiful and 80 degrees. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's what we had today, you know. And so we're looking for some weather coming in next week in here, some significant rain. And I'm sure we'll talk about that with our weekly guest, Chris from Maven's Notebook, because that's very important. Kind of dry this winter.
Absolutely. You know, the other day we awarded the city of Sacramento the winner of the National Mayor's Challenge for water conservation. We had a press conference on Monday, and we had Wyland, who's the one who's sponsored with the EPA, and we had Toyota. They gave away a $45,000 vehicle to a charity that the city picked, and that's for winning. Plus, we gave a lot of prizes out to the people who took the pledges to that, and we gave them away irrigation controllers, drip kits, some other things. So it was pretty successful. I'm sure you remember the event was about a half hour long, 45 minutes long, and had Daryl Steinberg, who used to be the assemblyman, and he's the mayor now of Sacramento. So he accepted the award on behalf of the Wyland Foundation. And it was a great event.
I listened to it, Rob, and I got seriously tropic denied when I saw Wyland's location where he was at in the picture that he showed at the end of his little speech.
Yeah, that's at his Florida home. He has an even nicer one in Hawaii. And then he also has that one that you and I've been to in Laguna. So. So he's a good man, and he stands up for water conservation. And as he said on, I guess you heard, the Olympics has made him the official painter for the water activities. So that's going to be pretty nice. He'll be doing some painting on that. So that'll be great. But anyway, we should talk about California water news, and we should bring in the most famous person we know who knows all about that, the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, is Chris Austin. Chris, welcome to the Water Zone.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Awesome.
Boy, awesome.
It was a beautiful day here in Southern California.
No doubt.
It started off cold, frost on the cars, but boy, it sure warmed up this afternoon. Open up all the doors and windows and let the fresh air in.
Absolutely. So, you know, everybody says you can't get anything for free, but I know you got a webinar coming up. It's going to be pretty awesome. You want to tell our listeners about it so anybody can join in?
This is going to be a fun one. You know, sometimes I do really technical webinars, but this one was actually, the idea sort of sprouted from a couple articles that in the news that described California water wars. And we hear that a lot. And so the title of the webinar is Water Wars, What Are They Good For? And, you know, and it's really going to be exploring this dialogue of why do we always, you know, see this in terms of conflict and as unresolvable problems. And, you know, there are other ways to manage this. You know, and there are ways, you know, it isn't always a zero-sum game. There are ways for people to come together and come up with solutions that really solve problems. So it will be interesting. We have some really great panelists. We have Tim Quinn, who used to be the executive director of the Association of California Water Agencies. We have John Fleck. He is the author of a book on the Colorado River, about myths about the Colorado River. So, it was a book on how a lot of the agencies on the Colorado River came together and solved their problems. And then because, you know, you need to have someone sort of on the opposite side, we have Tracy Quinn, who is with the NRDC, and the NRDC is a big litigator in a lot of these, a lot of different water issues across the state and the nation, quite honestly. So we wanted to bring in someone who kind of goes on those sorts of tactics, and we're looking to have a fun conversation and, you know, and try and get everybody together and have a great conversation. And it's free. And what better time to have a webinar on water wars than high noon on the Ides of March?
So. That's absolutely. And I got some good intro music for you for that show.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you should send it to me, because we're definitely playing music. I mean, this is the kind of fun we're going to have.
That was by the Temptations.
That's hilarious, Rob.
I'll keep my day job, sorry guys.
Yeah, so that's your music background coming through right there.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, Chris. I mean, you know, going right to the heart of the problem and should be good. So I hope you can record it. Maybe for some listeners who miss it, we can play some segments on the show later on, Rob. Maybe, huh? Let's think about that.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. It will be recorded, and I don't have the little ad up on my website tonight, but I'll have it up there tomorrow. I'm slightly unprepared, I guess, but yeah, it's free. Sign up. We're going to have some fun. We'll play some music. We'll have some great panelists, and we'll really kind of dig into this question. So
awesome.
And speaking of digging into things, they had a snow survey this week on Tuesday, which is largely a media event where they go up and, you know, a guy sticks a pole in the snowpack and they measure how much water is in that little slug of snow they pull up. But the truth is they have much better accuracy at determining these things than just the guy on snowshoes with the pole in the snow. We have progressed in our technology. But what it does is it provides an opportunity every month during the winter to kind of get an update on what our water supply is going to be like for the next year. And the snowpack's very important for that, because really the snowpack is California's largest reservoir. It holds more water than all the reservoirs in the state that we have combined when it's, you know, when there's a great snowpack up there. And it's a real concern that as we kind of go into climate change and the snowpack is getting less and less, seems like every year, and we have a lot of these really dry years. I mean, this is really where the problem of our water supply is, the crux of it is, that our snowpack is diminishing. And we've always counted on that snowpack to melt off slowly and fill the rivers and streams through, you know, the late spring and the summer and sometimes into the fall. So, you know, without that snowpack, it's a real issue. And so they did this snow survey, and it's not looking good. I took a look at the numbers. The latest storm did boost us up. Prior to the last storms that sort of went through the last week or two up in Northern California, we'd almost been tracking as badly as we were in the 2014 drought. Now we're a little bit better, but you know, it's not looking good, and there's not a lot of precipitation on the horizon. There's some, but in the amount that we need to really get a great healthy snowpack up there, it's unlikely to come. The probability is not great.
What do you think Sacramento's going to do?
Well,
about the,
when there isn't much snow up there, then what happens is there isn't a great allocation for the water projects. And down here in Southern California, we have a contract for water from the State Water Project, and it supplies about 30% of the water to Southern California. And the Department of Water Resources, you know, Southern California is one of 29 contractors, but it is the largest. We have Southern Metropolitan Water District has the largest share of the State Water Project, about a quarter of it, 25%. And so the State Water Project captures the water, and then every year they issue an allocation. It's kind of based on everyone's percentage of what they've contracted for, because they never have 100%. Very rarely, we have had instances where there's been 100% and everyone got all of the water that they asked for, but it's only probably been in maybe 2 or 3 years in the history of the State Water Project, which was built in the 1960s. You know, so it's not a common occurrence. So you're always getting a percentage of the amount that you've contracted for. And so far, the state has issued an initial allocation of 5%, which is what they did, I think, back in January. And it's not unusual, especially if there's not a lot of precipitation, for them to issue something very low. But if there isn't more significant precipitation during the subsequent months, then it doesn't move very much. And so I imagine that hopefully there'll be a little bit more and people will get more than 5% of the water that, you know, that they've contracted for, and which is much less than, you know, what they're used to getting. But all signs are just kind of pointing to that this is going to be another dry year, and probably what they would term a critically dry year. So long story short, I guess it's too late for that, huh? We should all expect water restrictions, I think, in the summertime, barring any amazing amount of precipitation that might come through. It has happened. But you know what actually happened this year? All our water got steered to the north. If you look at how the atmospheric rivers, these storms that bring the precipitation, how they hit, they all went into Oregon and primarily into Washington. And Washington has had, like, they're calling it a winter and a half. They have so much snow up in Washington. So Washington, the state of Washington, has taken our water. So I just want to point that out. They have our snow.
We need to build tunnels to move tunnels and pipelines to move some of the water. You know, do you think it's going to get back to where this governor now will demand a 25% reduction in water use like the last one did?
You know, they'll probably start out. In the beginning in the drought last time around, they started out with voluntary actions, and they asked everybody to please conserve water. And, you know, that got everything to a certain point. But Californians really did respond, and they really did save water, and they're I don't know if there's going to be drought regulations coming down the line like there were before. It's a possibility. I don't know. I guess we all kind of have to sit here and wait and see what happens. But I think we all should be prepared to, you know, be very conscious of our water use, which you should be anyway. But
yeah, I know Chris Davey and I praised a lot of the water agencies in California because of their education outreach that they did, which we thought was very excellent and such. But then, if you remember, there was a lot of lawsuits against the state, like from Western Municipal Water and others saying, hey, we've been saving water for years. Our customers have been doing it. We can't get below this. And we have tons of underground water, groundwater that they could use. And they had enough for years to come. But I guess they finally dropped all the suits.
Yeah, and that's kind of the problem when you try and take a one-size-fits-all approach to things. Because, you know, these, and particularly down here in Southern California, during that last drought, while we had to conserve and there were restrictions, we did really pretty darn well. And the reason why we did well is because when they had the drought here in 1994, there was very little storage down here in Southern California, and they really relied on these aqueducts to bring water down. And when there wasn't any water to bring down, it was very, very difficult. And they had serious restrictions on water use. And after that point, the water agencies got together and they said, you know, we got to do something about this. And so Metropolitan Water District built Diamond Valley Lake, which is down in eastern Riverside County. It's 800,000 acre feet of water reservoir that's intended to have 6 months of emergency water supply capability for Southern California. And Metropolitan went big on water banking and putting water into storage in wherever they could find water banks, and there's a number of them in southern Kern County. So in a water bank, it's kind of like a money bank. They put the water in the ground, and at a later date, they can pull that water out of the ground. And if it's in Kern County, they just put it into the aqueduct, and over the Tehachapis it comes, and here's the water. But basically, and that's just what Metropolitan did, but there were a lot of other agencies down here in Southern California that similarly said we got to be better prepared, and they prepared drought management plans, and when it came, they put these things into action. So the fact that we didn't feel that drought as much as they did up in Northern California is a result of the planning of the water agencies down here in Southern California. So, you know, we should all be appreciative of that. And this year with the drought, it won't be as bad as it could be, because I know Metropolitan has a lot of water in storage. I'm not sure what's sitting in Diamond Valley Lake, but, you know, they're prepared for this.
Yeah, so Chris, if you look at the reservoir map of California, Diamond Valley Lake isn't on that map currently, even the one that was produced for March 1st. And you know I'm an ardent viewer of that map every month.
That's because that map is of the reservoirs on the State Water Project and some of the Central Valley Project, the federal project. But Diamond Valley Lake is a metropolitan, in a sense, as compared to those, it's a local reservoir owned locally, not like a state or federal. So that's why it's not there. And if you go on the Metropolitan website and you dig around, you can actually find the level. But you do kind of have to dig a little bit. But
yeah, it's there. It's on MWD's site. It's also one of the things also interesting to point out, and I've said this in a couple of presentations that I've done. done in the past on you know, water capacity in California is the, you know, four or five, the top handful of the largest lakes in California, water storage lakes under the project, are in Northern California, right? Trinity and Shasta and Lake Oroville. They're not here in Southern California.
No, they're not, because all the precipitation falls up there.
Exactly.
I mean, this is where Metropolitan really came into play by building Diamond Valley Lake and investing in water banking programs, groundwater banking in Kern County. And, you know, but yeah, that's sort of our hydrology. It's sort of all backwards. And then you have the San Luis Reservoir, which is by Los Banos, and that one's 2 million acre feet. But that reservoir is 50% federal. Well, it's like 55% state, 45% federal, or it's split between the state and federal projects. But that, interestingly about that reservoir, is it's just intended to be agricultural water, not water supply. So it's intended to be filled up in the springtime and to be pretty much empty by the fall. So, you know, you shouldn't be all stunned if it's low, you know, come September. But if it's low come, you know, June or July, then it's a problem for the farmers, you know. So,
has either of you heard any update on Cadiz water out in Riverside and San Bernardino County that I know went through with lots of legalities over the last couple of years and finally be able to pump their water? And they supposedly had one of the largest underground storage of water in the state. Have anybody heard any updates on that?
I haven't seen anything on that in a long time, actually. And that's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't even really thought about it. Yeah, you know, but in terms of amount of water, the amount of water that, if my memory serves me correctly, that the Cadiz project was expected to provide was about 50,000 acre feet, which is not a tremendous amount of water. For comparison, like Metropolitan's stake in the state water supply in the state water project is 1 million acre feet.
Right.
So there were some, I've actually seen some false comparisons like, well, you don't need the state water project because we got Cadiz, and it's kind of like, not really.
Yeah, I think they had an issue back. They were worrying about bromine or something in the water, and you know, Metropolitan Water was under contract to take a bunch of the water, and then when the drought hit, they said, no, we can't take it. And I had heard that behind the scenes they didn't want to say they had water, a bunch of water to use. But I don't know, that's all political, and I couldn't get the right story out of that. But I was just curious. I haven't heard anything in at least a year about Cadiz. That was supposed to be a big deal. It goes way back.
Actually, Metropolitan had some kind of interest in it, I think, way back in, might have been even the 90s or the early 2000s. And then everyone got in an uproar, including Senator Feinstein, and Metropolitan backed out. And I don't think they've ever, I never got the impression that they came back to the table. But Metropolitan's involvement is that they have the aqueduct that could carry the water into Southern California, which is where Cadiz has sold the water to. But, if, you know, the question, they're trying to get the right of ways, but, you know, to place their pipeline where the rail lines are right now to take it to the Colorado River Aqueduct. But I have never heard Metropolitan say that they're going to, that they will put that water in the aqueduct.
Yeah. Well,
Metropolitan's been curiously silent on this whole thing.
Go ahead, Chris.
On purpose.
You were breaking up.
I breaking up?
No, of Chris Davey.
Oh. Yeah, so I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that project. The Trump administration did some things that made some things easier, but I still don't have the sense that that project has come to fruition.
Yeah, you're probably right. Well, we're about coming up to our commercial break, and Chris, as always, we love to have you on the show every week. And for our listeners, to get the latest in California water news, the best place to get it is at Maven's Notebook, which is www.mavensnotebook.com. You can become a subscriber. You can also become a sponsor. It's a great way to get news brought to you every single day. It was right up on your computer. The first thing when I turn my computer on every morning, it's right there. I take a look at the reading of it, and I get really great information. And that's what I know Chris reads it every single day as well. So, Chris, thank you very much for coming this week. We will talk to you again next week, and you hope to have a great week. And most importantly, stay safe from COVID.
Oh, yes, and it's always a pleasure. And, yes, everyone stay safe. Wear your mask.
Yeah, thanks. All right, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back in just a minute for our featured guest, so stick around. And you're with Rob and Chris.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toro's water-efficient precision nozzles. Site One Landscape Supply has over 30 locations right here in Southern California, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States. Site One's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, SiteOne has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants for your yard, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control products, landscape accessories, hardscape products, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you or stop by today. SiteOne, we are stronger together.
Anyone and everyone can participate to help store huge amounts of water, carbon, and returning vital nutrients to our soils without the use of chemical fertilizers.
Putting chemicals onto the soil, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and trying to backfill with some of the micronutrients, trying to do that, we, in essence, killed the life in the soil. Recycling's been taking place for a lot of years. People know about recycling an aluminum can, but when I was just a little girl, my father told me it ought to be a crime to landfill anything organic. Life in the soil around the roots of the plant, and then the plants can grow huge. Our soil is starving for organic matter.
Well, welcome back, everybody. It's the second half of the Water Zone Radio Show. I think we're waiting for Rob to come back on the air.
Oh, I'm here. I thought you were gone. I guess we got disconnected for a little bit. So sorry about that. Little technical problems. Always that way when you're not in the studio, like we always have been.
I did, Rob. I sent you a little note over the commercial break as to what was going on with my connection here, but I think we're okay now.
Okay. I'll let you take the honors and introduce our featured guest, because I'm very happy to have this person come on the show. And it's a world of information. We're going to get a world of information.
I'd be happy to do that. So our next guest, somebody who's been on the show before, a great contributor that first time, a great contributor to the irrigation industry or the green industry as a whole. And by the way, I'll just make a note, as well as Rob and myself, she is now a member of the Green Industry Hall of Fame as of the 2020 induction. So I'd like to welcome to the show Kathy Kellogg. Kathy is the chairwoman for Kellogg Garden Products. And Kathy, I know we're going to have a great session this afternoon or this evening talking about this. Welcome again to the Water Zone.
Thank you, Chris. Now, don't you not sell your own self. You were an inductee into the Green Industry Hall of Fame on the very same day.
I was indeed. We stood shoulder to shoulder during the photo taking, even though that wasn't copacetic for the 6 foot for the social distancing, but we were masked to the hilt.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, shoulder to shoulder, more back to back. Remember when we finally revealed a smile?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's
all right.
The thing I miss the most about COVID is seeing people smile. There's something about that that's such a connection, and it was good to at least see people smile and then put our masks right back on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
you're talking about masks and smiles.
I take my daughter's view on that. She's kind of an optimistic view of it. She just assumes everyone is smiling under their mask.
Well, you can buy a mask that has a smile face on it.
You can.
There you go. And they even have, I saw one today that's a full face mask of a person.
Oh, how funny. I bet you could put your own face on a mask, actually.
Yep.
Why didn't I think of that a year ago? Darn it.
Well, let me start off, Kathy. I'm going to ask you a question here, right? Because I know that you're your company is a very family-oriented business, been in business for many, many decades, has a serious view of the industry and of natural resources and everything else. So I happen to know that you had the occasion last week to visit the Heritage Museum in Orange County, and I know that has a family link to you guys. So before we get talk into the other subject matter that we will. Give us a little background on your visit last week.
Well, thank you. You know, it was such an epiphany. For those of you who are not familiar with the Heritage Museum of Orange County, it is, been around about 30 years. And my father actually contributed the main building to this outdoor 20-plus acre museum. It features the turn of the century, meaning turn of the former century, 1899 is when the house was built. It features what it was like to live in Orange County. And pre-COVID and pre-pandemic, they received about 20,000 children a year that get to walk through the museum and try on the costumes and churn butter and watch oranges grow and be introduced to the citrus industry that began in the 1890s and really flourished in the 1920s. And I came upon what connected it to us and our interview tonight, came upon an article in 1906, and it featured great grandpa Kellogg and his work on conveying water to Southern California, to Arizona, and in Hawaii. And it was his engineering that allowed for the citrus industry to get started. And I don't mean to grasp, you know, too much credit at all. I just meant it was shocking and surprising and awesome to think that there was this early work at the turn of the century recognizing that in order to have an industry at all, one had to first deal with the water. That was one epiphany. And then as it was settling in, I realized Grandpa Kellogg, who was the founder of Kellogg Garden Products in 1925, he saw fit to recover organic materials, especially he saw that kind of the waste of all this organic material that came in the sewer system should be applied to soil. It should enrich our soil. Was beginning to show the depletion of growing crop after crop after crop. It needed organic material to resuscitate basically the life in the soil. And then I reflected on Dad, who was the second generation of Kellogg. He really was passionate about recovering organic waste products like rice hulls and bark and manure and bringing them together to build soil health. And he just really strongly advocated that, what are we thinking about burying organic materials in a tomb to last hundreds of years and actually taking away a canyon, you know, from a beautiful natural landscape and making it into a big pile of garbage, if you will, when most of what we were throwing away is organic, can be decomposed, can enrich soil. So that was his champion of that generation. And it just caused me to, you know, really think that there's been a generational desire to build soil throughout the Kellogg.
Well, it's not only that 100 years ago, people were, you know, discarding organic material, right? Just thinking that it was quote unquote trash, you know, when it's really a gem, right? Or a diamond in the rough or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, a treasure, right? One man's trash is another man's treasure. I think we've embodied that for all the generations. And it was kind of a neat moment to reflect on that, to stand in the Heritage Museum of Orange County and realize that this generation, and our company's into the fourth generation now, that really has a focus on the carbon effect of storing organic matter in soil. You know, we've put a lot of the carbon in the atmosphere, which doesn't do any favors for the climate having a temper tantrum. There's a lot too much carbon in the atmosphere, and it should be in the soil. And yet it is within our purview, it is within our power, it is within humanity's capability to restore soil with organic matter that just has been misplaced. It's been harvested. It's been landfilled. Now we can work nice and hard in restoring soil.
Well, not only does it help restore the soil, but it also helps conserve water as well. You know, putting water on dead soil isn't going to help much at all.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. The connections were just giving me goosebumps, and so I had to send it over to you, that article from 1906, and there has to be 200 pages of material written at the turn of the century that is in the similar vein. So I'll share that with you gentlemen off air.
What a find. Kathy, I mean, as you said, send chills up and down your spine, right? It must have done that. Did the museum curators know it was there before you arrived, or were they aware of its existence?
No, we had some neat discoveries. They had some of H. Clay Kellogg's journals, but I must have the original, in which he's pasted articles and then written notes about his engineering and the dam in Hawaii and the whole water system that he created, the water system that brings the water from the Ewa side of Oahu over to the Waikiki side, and the engineering of the Nu'uanu Dam and the Waimea Project. So all this was, again, in the early, early turn of the century years, the importance of water. It is, you know, I guess sometimes I feel like I've taken it for granted, all the engineering that has gone on before me, that I could just turn on a tap and have a glass of water. It's pretty miraculous.
It is just so fascinating that to hear that story, and thanks for sharing it. I really hope you, I'm sure you did, but I really hope you shared it with the all your colleagues at Kellogg Garden Products as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a lot of feedback on it. It was nice, but I'm going to dig deeper because everyone was really interested in it.
Wow.
Just amazing to find that you've got, you know, a 100-year-old background in the irrigation industry, especially in the beginning of development of conveyance systems for agriculture. Just a fantastic find. I'm so happy for you.
Well, you know, you guys were my inspiration. You let me see the 100 year anniversary book of Toro. And I am inspired and I'm on my way to writing with lots of help the 100th anniversary story of Kellogg.
Well, the only difference is you're a private company and we're a public company. And I would buy stock in your company, but you're not issuing any to the public. So. But we do. And Kathy, you know, my wife and I buy your products not because we know you, because it's a good product, and it really does wonders for the things that my wife grows. But that leads me into a question for you. So, you know, I see people going to the big box stores or the small nurseries, and they buy plants and trees and all kinds of stuff, and then they don't know what they should plant in it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just think of the dirt as dirt. they don't understand about amendments or anything. What's the things that they need to know? If you just a layperson going to a big box store and you know, because you make products for all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 227 products, I think, at the latest count.
Wow.
all to help plants grow.
Yeah. Can you give a little bit of...
It's a great question, and I admire the packaging and the people who have thought through what to say. You have a 2 cubic foot bag, you know, a couple feet to explain as much as possible to a person that is starting gardening. That's been the characteristic of trying to convey information to a person standing in the garden center. What do? I've got a tomato plant. We have gone to icons on the bag that show that you want, for example, I mean, we could geek out about soil if you want.
yes, we do.
We want to geek out? Okay, good. That, you know, soft root systems like flowers and vegetables, and you can picture the soft roots as I talk about it. They need space in an often compact soil. So we designed the product Amend, and they're on the Garden in Bloom side, our Harvest Supreme, as a soil that would enrich the physical nature of the soil in addition to the chemistry of the soil and the biology of the soil. So if I often teach on this triangle, soil has, you know, the triangular needs. It has a physical nature. It's to be compact like clay. It can be loose like sand. It has a chemical nature, meaning, does it have enough nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, calcium? Does it have nutrients for the plants there to absorb? And so physical, chemical, and biological. You all, thank you for playing my TED Talk on an episode earlier this year. You'll see that I land pretty heavily that biology in the soil is something that is the most important thing we could do for our plants, is to provide a biological environment, one that has the protozoa and bacterium that has the ability for the plant to interact with the plant and to exchange sugars with the plant and to aid the plant in its photosynthetic grab of that sun energy and deposit it inside of the soil. There's an interaction that happens in soil, and the more biologically alive the soil is, the better that interaction is. So back to the simple solution, Kellogg's kind of got it wired. We have icons on the bag when you go into the store, and it says, I've got a tomato plant. I need something to plant and amend my soil. Amend is the ideal purchase. You go into the same store, but you're buying a rose. You're buying a woody root system. You can picture the difference between a bare root rose or a bare root fruit tree and this soft rooted tomato, right? You can kind of picture the difference. So in that woody environment, you want a more fungal dominated soil. You want a soil amendment that has been nicely rotted like we do for you at Kellogg. You want a lot of woody material that has been decomposed but still holds space for oxygen and moisture. And so grow mulch, that product that Grandpa created for Walt Disney, grow mulch is the ideal soil in a especially Southern California environment. We tend to have, as you know, hard water. We tend to have high pH soil. We tend to have compact soils. So it was designed to fight basically all of that and to add nutrients with physical structure and biology. And then you've got your perfect planting mix for any sort of shrub, tree, bush. That's grow mulch. And so we won't go through all 227 products. But when you go in the store, you'll see that Topper is designed for lawns. You know, it's same thing. It is actually made into a much smaller particle size, noting that grasses really need that organic material to sift between them and land on the soil. And then that soil interaction, right, creates the biology that then enables the grass to be in and of itself a healthy plant. Each blade sometimes is its own plant, depending on your species of grass, of course. So the products that we feature in all the independent nurseries and in the Home Depot and Lowe's, those products are carefully composted so that the gardener can really play around with them. Is there, can I say idiot-proof on the radio?
Yes, you can.
Sure. you can't go wrong with amending soil. And, Chris, I think you were asking, too, about whether when you're planting native plants,
yes,
whether it's a good idea to amend your soil.
Right. I was asking that. I went to the, back when Santa Ana Botanical Gardens was called that. Now it's called California Native Gardens, Botanical Gardens, rather. I went to a class there, and they said you shouldn't do anything to the soil, especially if you live in Claremont on this alluvial fan. Just leave it the way it is, because the biological structure between plants is what works best. It doesn't work if you water into, if you dig a little moat around each plant and water it. It doesn't work. So I was very interested in that answer.
Yeah. The missing link in the conversation is that in especially Claremont, lovely native soil. However, when they built the home or they built the tract of homes, large dirt moving equipment came in and shoved that lovely soil aside, leaving subsurface or subsoil. This is soil without biology and without structure and without the very thing that the Native Plant Society is saying our plants need to survive. So in order to restore nature, the best method to do that is a very nicely composted soil amendment. And again, we've found that depending on what you're planting, we've kind of made a planting mix that is designed to complement the soil. It's designed to go in 50-50, and then when your plant is planted, you can rely on the soil to start to rebuild that natural mycorrhizal fungi, the natural and very robust life in the soil that you really can't depend upon it to happen without a very lovely amendment from the beginning.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. 23 years ago when I planted my native garden, right? It's the old thing, I wish I knew now what I didn't know then. contrary to the information I was getting, I did mulch. I put native mulch and, I let the leaves lay on the soil. And this year, my garden is as healthy and sprightly and green and blooming as ever.
Yeah, good job. And that the idea of leaving organic materials on top of the soil to add to the organic matter is brilliant. And it's almost like the field of dreams. You know, if you will build it, they will come. But soil biology is like that. You need to start it and then you will have a beautiful result. And I bet it's, how many years in are you now with your garden?
23, so I planted that garden in like 1998.
Wow. It's also so nice when, you know, you can, at this point, amend each year a little bit or top dress with a really nicely composted mulch just to continue to protect the roots of the plants from the heat. You know, the heat of the summers and the cold of the evenings, a very nicely composted mulch does act like a blanket and a sun protectant at the same time. And they allow that biology right underneath the mulch to have that interaction with the roots, so, and keep the moisture around the roots of the plant and reduce the amount of watering necessary.
Exactly. Last time we talked, as I said, I was so interested in the answer to that, and I've taken it to heart. And for the, and for our listeners here, I'm just going to put a little plug in here, Kathy, but go to the Kellogg website, right, kelloggarden.com. I mean, you want information, there is so much stuff on there, not just native plants, but vegetables, herbs, flowers, if it's organic, if it's, you know, fall, winter, spring, whatever, succulents, anything. There's charts, there's guides, there's tons of information on there that's just so valuable to any gardener, green thumb or not.
Yeah, it's fun. We have at least five downloadable worksheet books. Actually, books that have been claimed by the millions, because you just go on and you can download a guide to your own garden. You can just steps to do one at a time. Lots of information for those wonderfully welcome to the new gardeners during COVID and during this pandemic. There has been the emergence of first-time gardeners like we've never seen before. And the return of people to gardening that have said, even as 2021 marches along, they're going to continue on their projects in their backyard.
Yeah. So I have a question for both of you from different points of view. So, Chris, I know you have beautiful gardens, both vegetable and flowers, because I've been there many times, and it's awesome. And I know Kathy had shown me some pictures of her home and her gardens, and they're beautiful. Plus, I've been to one of her facilities where they grow some stuff out there, and it's pretty, pretty neat. So would you consider, since on native plants, that they should get overhead watering or drip?
No water. Just hand watering if it's really hot and you have severe weather. That's really what I do with my native garden. I don't have an irrigation system installed, so it's either what nature provides or what I supplement if needed in an emergency.
You know, we work for Toro. We can get some irrigation products for you.
I've also got, you know, 5,600 square feet of turf, so Toro is well represented.
Absolutely. I know that for a fact. Kathy, what do you like to see in your garden?
I agree with Chris completely, but drip irrigation is throughout my personal yard and our headquarters garden, which we were asking about or saying at Kellogg. We grow some pretty mighty vegetables in raised beds, and we have drip irrigation. I find that overhead irrigation has the potential to either sunburn leaves, you know, done at the wrong time, or create a little fungus on your, depending, you know, on your squash. So always have enjoyed the Toro product that I use. And thank you very much, because you helped me with a timer once. Very helpful.
No problem. We appreciate everything that you do. I know you don't particularly give tours, but when I was at, you were gracious to have me come over one day and look at your facility. And ever since then, I remember these 18 wheelers were loading up and moving all this stuff, and I see them on the highways everywhere. I mean, big 18 wheeler trucks with nothing but Kellogg's product. Though. So you got a great business and great reputation.
Thank you. It's my favorite site. To
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now.